beat around the bush so much. All right, intro ready. 3, 2, 1, go. And we're back. Hey, everyone. Sorry for the double intro button press. It just hit the wrong button and not enough caffeine in the veins to register that quickly enough. Maybe it's because I drank my espresso out of this weird little Santa cup today, but threw me off my game. But anyway, welcome to the Digital Cash Rundown, episode 140. I'm joined by the one and only Nate of Eat Sleep Crypto. How's it going, man?
Good to see you, Joel. Thanks for bringing me on again.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for being here. I would say you seem well, except it looks like you're in heaven right now, which doesn't sound like a good sign. Like, I mean, did you get hit by a bus or something?
Yeah, right. As you can tell by my background, I'm in sunny Puerto Rico. We got the ocean. It's a little calmer than it usually is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, doing well.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, so before we jump into the show, just everyone remember, you can throw me some super chats in the typical YouTube-y type fashion. As soon as it becomes possible on Twitter, as soon as Elon gets back to me and wants to throw me a bag, then that'll be fine. Otherwise, obviously, my Discord, which I see XK's in there, hi, and Digital Cash Rundown channel. And there's a lot of interesting discussions on the whole code is law thing, which is it's very interesting. So let's actually just get into what triggered, or at least the source material for starting to talk about this. All right, so here we go. So Victor Charpia on Twitter was posting something about there's apparently a trial that, anyway, so this account from the trial further confirms that this French judge bought a version of code is law theory. There was a hacker, the hacker's interaction with the smart contract actually created a contract between the hacker and the protocol, namely a loan. And then I'm going to scroll down to read this a little bit more. Now, the loan transferred the ownership of the exploited crypto to the hacker, so there couldn't be a theft since the hacker theoretically owned the exploited sums at the moment. So the transfer is based on a contractual relationship. Somehow there cannot be fraud. It's further confirmed by blah, blah, blah. It says you cannot be found guilty based on criminal law, but the loan still exists and you owe me the borrowed sums on Platypus DeFi. So, yeah, anyways, he says, I think this line of reasoning is insane. I can understand the defense attorney used it. I would have done the same. But see, the judge's side, it feels like this was treated with little consideration to the real-world consequences, namely making France look like North Korea. A little hyperbolic there, maybe. But, yeah, so this whole thing is pretty crazy where literally, first off, do you know this? Are you very familiar with this case? Because I'm not. I'm kind of, this is the extent of my familiarity with this exact case.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm familiar with the hack and maybe to a lesser extent, the case. My interests lie more in the crypto economic security side of things rather than the French law and legal theory side. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, what actually happened with the hack?
Sure. So, Platypus has actually been hacked 3 times. And this one was due to the failure of the protocol to check that the emergency withdrawal function was excluding funds that were currently loaned. So mm-hmm. the attacker used a flash loan on Avalanche to basically get $44 million out of the contract and netted 8 of that, I think. And then after, they had some sloppy OPSEC, so they didn't end up with the entire amount. But the nuts and bolts of it, or like the long short, is that the attacker was able to use a flash loan, exploit the protocol in a way that the protocol was maybe not intended to behave, but the code certainly indicated that the protocol was intended to behave this way. Because code, you cannot code intent in a meaningful way. Circumventing the argument that comes from this new word intents that's being used in DeFi. Skipping that, the code of a protocol is like the final decision maker on what that code does. The same as a legal contract is supposed to be the definitive word on what a legal contract does. And I guess there are different schools of thought within law that that would say, no, the code is supposed to be, or the legal contract is supposed to be interpreted by the courts to determine intent. But these are two schools of thought in law, and they're also, you know, they extend to two schools of thought within DeFi and in crypto with smart contracts. So you have the one school saying that, you know, what we understood what the protocol was supposed to do. Clearly, the protocol didn't want someone to be able to withdraw, emergency withdraw funds that weren't theirs. But the, you know, the actual effect of the protocol and the way that it was coded in, that ability was given to anybody that had access that wanted to call the smart contract and use a flash loan to do it. So you've got, you know, law is law and code is law. These are kind of the two schools of thought that have arisen in crypto.
Yeah. And the funny thing about that in this, in the kind of exploit type situation is, the big difference, there's two huge differences in that. Just before we even go into the is code law kind of discussion, it just, first of all, a law, a contract in a legal sense, is an agreement, a binding agreement between parties that the parties go into and agree. And whereas a code, not necessarily, it's just the code that governs the machine, because that's what it is, it's a machine, and people who engage in it think the machine's going to work a certain way, and that's why they engage in it. They don't agree to the terms of, they don't agree at all. They just use it, and it just works. And so there's like an implied consent, or there is an explicit consent to a certain extent in law versus in code, whereas code is just like you use a machine and it does what the output is. And so if there is a undesired outcome in a legal situation, it's kind of like, well, you read it, you agreed to it, like, sorry, that's it, that's what happened. Whereas if there's an unintended consequence in, say, like a crypto network, and like a chain halt or something, you're not just like, well, the chain decided to halt, we all agree that's what was going to happen. It's like, no, do we fix it? You change the rules so that you get the outcome that you wanted. And it, of course, not, the decentralization part is you can't arbitrarily change the rules. One party can. You got to do other things. But so it's kind of wild to say like that this is like a legally binding sort of contract that just like, well, if it didn't work, it didn't work. And then the other difference is contracts, legal contracts in the meat space are not self-executing. They're a framework of agreement for enforcement. There is not a single law in the world, as far as I'm aware, that is not enforced by human discretion to a certain extent. Even though it's supposed, it's like written law, you still have to have someone enforce law, like a cop comes up or whatever, and then you still have to have like a judge to decide if it ends up in court. It's so, it's kind of like it's two layers. So first of all, to recap that, with law as opposed to code law, with law, you actually agree to it. There is an agreement to abide by the terms of this contract. Whereas there is no such agreement with code as law. There's just using the machine, and the machine agrees to abide by its own law. And so you can't get mad at the machine for doing what it agreed to do. But the individual is not like, oh, buyer beware. Well, sort of, but like also there's that. And then the second thing is there's humans that interpret law and enforce law. There's some, you know, kind of thing like that. Whereas with crypto and stuff like that, it's just like, just it ran itself. It just, it did it on its own. No one was like, based on these parameters, the DAO is going to vote based on our charter to then transfer money to this hacker. That never happened. It was just, it automatically worked. So is code law in this case? My judgment is no. What do you think?
Interesting. So I like your description of law as law, because I too think there's an entertaining comedic aspect to the system of laws that we have in various jurisdictions nowadays. But So I think in traditional law, you've got kind of like three components, like three phases. You've got the contract, that's an agreement between two people, and they reference, usually, like they specify the courts, or there is a default court system that binds agreements between people of different jurisdictions or of a common jurisdiction. And then you have the court that's arbitrating, but it's not necessarily the court that's executing. It is also, like you said, the judgment or the understanding of the court that is injected into the contracts between people. And so we have use for things like precedent in courts, where you can interpret something based on how it's historically been interpreted. And there's a degree of subjectivity in law that there is not in code. And my take is maybe not, you know, as it relates to this case, I don't know what the correct ruling was from a precedent-based perspective, or a perspective that would come from French legal theory. But what I do see is that in DeFi, we have a different kind of system where there is no intent to infer. There is no subjectivity in the arbitration. And that's unique. And in my opinion, it's one of the main things. It underlies the main thing about crypto. The main value proposition of cryptocurrencies and DeFi is censorship resistance. Censorship resistance comes from the irreversibility of transactions. Right? This was Bitcoin's original innovation, was transactions that couldn't be stopped and couldn't be sent back. They couldn't be undone. And to undo a transaction is actually the worst kind of exploit in the Bitcoin system. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fair to say that this property of censorship resistance and irreversibility that is common to payments in crypto and the financial DeFi type transactions, as well as posting arbitrary data and everything else that people use blockchains for, this is the main value proposition of cryptocurrencies. And to take that away by, you know, whether explicitly or implicitly giving governments control over the finality of settlement in blockchain systems is to nerf the value proposition of crypto and DeFi almost to the point that it is of little use, because we already have a financial system with trusted third parties, regulators and middlemen, and you know, various participants that disrupt the flow of person-to-person transactions. So in my view, it's not so much the question is not so much whether the French decision was correct according to French law, but the implications if such a decision were adopted widespread. And so that's maybe what we'll talk about. And the case that I'd like to make is that DeFi thrives under decisions by courts that allow it to exist unimpeded by regulators.
Yes, I also agree with that. There's a different thing. The thing about code is law, there's a different way of phrasing that I would definitely agree with, because I don't think code is law. But code is law like the laws of nature. And so, for example, if there is a hurricane and it damages people's property, whatever court cases come out of that that thing, it's about how acting individuals have to act in the wake of this thing. It doesn't say hurricanes are therefore banned. Like, you know, you can't, but that's the laws of nature. And so in that sense, code is law, that it's like an act of nature. And I don't think that this French ruling is necessarily a good one, but I think it could be worse, in that if they ruled that the DeFi protocol has to pay back the users or whatever, because you can't tell the protocol what to do. It's an act of God, basically. It's a nature thing. You can, whoever runs it can of course fix it or change exploits or whatever. But like the super dangerous precedent is where you start to think that the laws of man govern the laws of God, more or less, or laws of nature. And that's kind of what it is. And so the code is a law of nature. That's the nuance that I would probably inject into this.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that reminds me of Vin Armani's take that Bitcoin is not money. It might do what money does, you know, or replace the need for money because it fulfills more or less the same role or a similar role, but better in some cases. But it is not itself money. And in the same way, of course, I don't think there are very many people that hold the view that code is law per se. But I think, like you said, a good way to phrase it might be code is a law of nature, or a way that I've heard it expressed is code should replace law, or code should be law. And to loop back around to how we started this episode, I think the best, something I tweeted this week, I saw Gabriel Shapiro's thread on this, where he basically made the case for code is law. And that's on my timeline if you want to pick that up and share that with the audience. But Gabriel's take was code is law, you know, so to speak, is the only way that DeFi can really work. Because if it's not, then we're just bringing in regulators all over again. And as any student of decentralized system knows, the system is only as decentralized as its most centralized part. So regulators become the trusted third party required to achieve settlement finality that Bitcoin disintermediated 15 years ago.
Well, so let's throw up this thing on the screen now. So he said, hard to explain this well on X, but yes, code must be law for DeFi to work. These systems would need to be designed completely differently if they're meant to be subservient to off-chain understandings. You can't reference that off-chain understanding only in the case of hacks. And so the thing about this thing, so the thing is, we must accept that code is law of nature. I'd give a little nuance there, because the problem with a completely code is law sort of an approach is then if you have some sort of DeFi exploit, then you rule that, you know. So for example, let's say in the case of an exploit where someone exploits some little thing, drains all the liquidity from some profile, from some pools of some, you know, project. Now he has it all. And then the people roll back the code to a way like an ETH classic type situation where, except, you know, it's not there, there's not a fork. Everyone kind of agrees with that. And then the hacker takes them to people court and to law court and says, I want my money back because code is law and the code gave it to me. And you broke the code. You broke the law to restore it. And that's a horrible precedent to set, because then you have all kinds of exploiters, scammers, whatever else, doing weird little things and then running to daddy government to go, you know, attack people who would, you know, revert that. Basically, it's a safe zone. I'm walking around with all this money now that I stole from everyone. It's in everyone's face. And then no one would use the system if this was the case. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle to that whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. And, you know, in either case, I suppose the ruling that I would like to see is that governments have no jurisdiction inside crypto. And yes. So when I tweeted that the best thing that lawyers could do, this is tying back to the blue pill, I think advocacy in crypto law is mostly blue pilled because it assumes that governments and regulators within government, because government's not monolithic, but it assumes that regulators and politicians are acting and arguing in good faith, which they are absolutely not. And yes. I think it is a weak position to assume they are. It puts you on the defensive, and it's a very hard spot to argue out of, because to them, might makes right, and whatever they say is the legal decision. You know, whatever they say is legal is by default ethical in their view. And as libertarians and as thinking people, we understand that legal and ethical are not synonyms, and that just because something is legal doesn't mean it's ethical. You don't need to point to too many examples to prove that case. What I would say is a purple pilled approach, or like a a right side of the curve and a left side of the curve simultaneously position that I think crypto lawyers could take is that code is law, right? You got both people saying code is law. This stupid, naive take is code is law. The intelligent take is code is law, and as lawyers, we can do something to set that precedent. So if we can get courts to rule that the kind of mishaps that happen in the process of building this alpha version software in our sandbox, you know, that whatever happens in that sandbox is kind of like a buyer beware environment, not protected by the usual, settlement layer of courts, mm-hmm. then we can build a much more robust system, because in that case, DeFi will start to mirror evolutionary processes like natural selection. And I have hope for this, because what we've seen over the last several years is that hack volumes, the volumes in hacks are slightly increasing, but as a percentage of total value locked across all chains, that number is decreasing, which tells us that hacks are becoming less severe and people are actually learning from their mistakes in smart contracts.
Yeah, which I hope, kind of continues as a trend. But that's kind of an interesting facet of this whole situation, is how does it interact with legal systems? And the thing is, I think that we're talking about the bell curve again. A lot of the world is just in this middle bell curve that just assumes that the way things usually work today is the way they've always worked, and that they always must work. And one thing that was kind of a little interesting, because I always had, very pro-freedom inclinations my whole life, but it was always the idea of no government was always a little sounds good, but I was always a little skeptical on that. And something that got me to rethink it a little bit in a more detailed way is in my in graduate school, I did a lot of international law studies. And international law is crazy, because it's a peer-to-peer law, and there's no enforcement mechanism. And so it's literally how people, because we're in this situation where we are all in most countries, right? Let's just say the first world, the rest Western world for now. We're under a system that rules us. The system tells us what we can and can't do, and it just owns the outcomes. Whereas in an international law system, there is no super government. There are attempts at making something like the UN where it's people just ignore whatever they... The thing is, one of the most fascinating things is extradition treaties and kidnapping and stuff, where according to basically international law, you cannot, if you have a fugitive in a different country, you have to get the government's permission to extradite them. But then Israel in particular started freaking kidnapping lots of people who were involved in some very bad things during the 1940s that I think we're all well aware of. And enough countries just sort of let it happen and didn't care that now it's kind of evolved into the judicial precedent has evolved to where now that's not really illegal anymore, right? You can actually kind of do that and get away with it. And so it's these collective sorts of agreements. And so basically I think that the law around code is what happens how do we deal with these hacks and things and exploits, and what precedent do we set to where there's an expectation? So I don't think there's a single case where someone exploits a DeFi protocol, does something that no one anticipated as possible and just takes a bunch of money, where that person is considered to be the rightful new owner of those funds. It's just not happening. Even if governments would say that, it wouldn't do anything. If governments did not explicitly enshrine the rights of the thief, then no one, any exchange said, you take the stolen funds from this guy, we're going to block it. Or someone just says, screw that guy, we're not going to take any money from him because he's a thief. And there's this general understanding. And so That is kind of an interesting part of, like, because code is, you know, code is, you know, I guess immutable until it gets changed. And what is, like, what should you or should you not be able to do with a protocol? According to the laws of nature, which is what code is, let's see. Let's press some buttons, see what happens. But then according to the people who built this tool to serve a very specific purpose, at some point there's some things that aren't, that go outside of that, and then that becomes an issue. And that's an interesting debate where the code is law thing now migrates us into the exciting, thrilling world of Bitcoin maximalism. So let's drop into that. So ordinals are a thing, and stamps as well. There are two different ways of basically, I don't know if I would call them an exploit, sort of, because Bitcoin chose to not scale on chain, but a bunch of soft forks through SegWit and some other things added in some capability to store extra data in ways that otherwise wasn't possible.
I think it's interesting that you say, I don't know whether this is an exploit or not, because with the code is law idea, the entire point is that no one can definitively determine whether it is an exploit. One man's feature is another man's bug.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's getting into an interesting position where people are using ordinals and stamps and putting a lot of money through it. And it's clearly, according to the code, not a bug in terms of it's possible. You just do it. You're arguing with the free market about what should be done. But the arguments seem to be that now Bitcoin cannot be used for the purpose for which it was built. Therefore, that is a bug that needs to be fixed. The problem is there's not social consensus. So let's just hit on this thing real quick. So they're considering a soft fork to forbid a subset of transactions, such as, you know, these specific kinds of things, which is kind of funny because this exact transaction type is literally the purpose of a lot of these upgrades in Bitcoin over the years. But the purpose, they wanted it to be some sort of a complicated settlement layer for payments for their buddies. But then someone's throwing monkey JPEGs through there and stuff. And that's like, but it's the same thing, but like, no, not, it's like, no, not like that. There's that meme too. Which we but anyway, so, yeah, they're talking about hard forks and stuff too. And then this Bitcoin Isaiah guy who's, you know, freaking maxi, but I like to troll him. Of course, he's a Bitcoin class of 2017, right? Like,
they all are. There's so few left. It's that brain drain.
I've seen him, though. Right? Like, there's some friends of mine who've been in crypto longer than me who are still kind of maxis. And they're still, but they're very few. So he says, damn, we might actually end up seeing a new fork war. It really just comes down to the miners. If the majority support restricting inscriptions, the JPEGers would be forced to fork off. And if the majority supports ordinals, the laser eyes would be forced to fork off, says someone with laser eyes in his bio. So what that has to do with that. But yeah, so it is interesting, right? For me, I love to, you know, I love this shit on Maxis, just what I do. But, and it's great for Twitter impressions, to be honest. I do it more than I otherwise would because of that. But it's apparently, like, the chain should not be used for those things. It should be used for payments, is what people are trying to say. I hesitate to call them people, but technically they are. But so they're saying this kind of stuff at the same time as they're trying to say that the chain is not for most payments. Those should be on Lightning or settlement layers or whatever else. They should only be for certain kinds of payments. And this whole, like, what is Bitcoin for debate? I understand it should. That sounds like a 2016, 2017 debate, but we're here again. That some people are trying to say, what is it for? Because I think that they tried to say it is for money and payments, but only in a way that, you know, enriches our own special interests. Just be super honest about that. And so now that it's for big other, they're settling data on the chain, they're settling monkey on chain. Now they're doing that instead of like, you know, that's somehow not a thing. And then there's like arguments about what should it be for and all this kind of stuff. So what's your hot take on that?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, you know, you hate to see it. In other ways, it's nice to see them eating their own dog food. You know, it's like what they've kind of created, because you and I both have been around for a long time and we've seen this entire narrative play out. Like we back in 2017, when the block size debates were really raging, 2016 to 2017, we were all saying like, well, if you don't want to increase it to 2 megabytes, why not just decrease it, right? Like how, if a smaller block size is better, why not reduce the block size? Why is 1 megabyte such a good number, right? And so this is kind of them coming home to roost. The you know, the hens are coming home to roost. And so I don't feel so much sympathy, but I also want to point to the underlying question there, which is, as in any decentralized system, and as with, you know, anarchic forms of organization, the question is always who decides. And that question right now is being answered by the people, you know, is being answered, the people with the loudest voice, the people who can shout the loudest on Twitter are in charge of and determine what Bitcoin is and what Bitcoin is good for. And there is, you know, there's also some weight to the answer that the community decides, but then the question becomes, who is the community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who actually gets to decide? And unfortunately, Bitcoin suffers from two problems. One is that it was, I mean, tons of problems, but let's just focus on two for now. The first one is that it was poorly defined. The limits of Bitcoin were poorly defined, because Bitcoin, the original purpose was very starkly defined, which is weird that it's muddy now, but whatever. The original purpose was very starkly defined, but then people started doing stuff like Satoshi Dice, and then they started doing, you know, counterparty assets and things like that. And they started colored coins, and just they started like trying to do other stuff with it. And that didn't end up being a problem until like the block size wars, where the argument was, oh, you don't need to do that, but then also you don't need to do small payments. And then, so first off, Bitcoin as crypto, it used to be everything, then became like, you could do everything on it until you have to then define it. Whereas anything that came after, like Ethereum is, if you're like, I can't buy my coffee with Ethereum, no one's going to cry. No one is going to cry, because no one thought that that was what it was for, because that was kind of what Bitcoin was for, or other things. Or Monero, it's very obvious what that's for, right? Zcash, it's very obvious what that was originally made for. All these other coins, it's a lot. So that's that problem. But then the other problem, of course, is how do you determine it? The other problem is when it underwent a pivot, which you'd have to be an absolute bad faith person or a moron to not acknowledge that there was a pivot at some point.
There are plenty of those.
Yeah, there's plenty of those. And you could say that, well, it was really you could call it righteous or originalist or whatever you want to call the pivot. It still was a pivot from the way it was used by and large to something a little bit different. When the pivot happened, in order to make that happen, the people in charge of the pivot who won went down a weird road of argumentation that didn't make any sense, but like worked enough to like get things through. And then now there's a lot of things that just aren't super clear, such as before it was hash rate decides, but then you went from like a 50 to 60% hash rate supporting a block size increase to then with the New York agreement, now you had 90%+ hash rate supporting SegWit and a block size increase just to like get things moving. And they got SegWit, but then the block size increased, time went, and then all of a sudden miners weren't in charge anymore because the group made it up on the fly about how are we going to just get our way anyway. And like, well, no, nodes, individual users. So we're going to simple attack the network, call it UASF, and then we just like scare people, and then just the rest is history. So then it's just like, okay, well, node runner, like if you run a node, you decide. And okay, so what's going to happen now? what if enough people start running nodes, and you know, what if there's like a what if they fork off, like at some point it's like which chain it's a hard fork. Like, here's the thing with the governance thing, right? The user activated soft fork, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean, was basically just forking nodes off of the dominant chain. And basically when you have a split, it's just like, all right, well, this one has more hash rate, but this one has all these nodes on it. Therefore, this one is more true or economically viable or whatever. And so, but where are we today with that? And like, who decides what it is for and what it isn't for? And also, when you start trying to decide that some things aren't for certain things, what's the collateral damage? And guess what? Let's throw up some of this collateral damage right now. Samurai Wallet. So Samurai Wallet basically said, we can confirm that Ocean Mining has enacted a policy of censoring Whirlpool CoinJoin transactions, private Bitcoin, basically, and BIP47 transactions as of December 6th, blah, blah, blah. And then Luke Jr., wonderful man, says, this is a bug in your software, not an intentional policy on our end. Blah, why are you exceeding? And he's doing all this crazy gaslighting stuff. And as a result, because Ocean Pool is Jack Dorsey's new pool that was supposed to be, oh, this is super decentralizing mining, and the only thing anyone's talking about is how it's censoring like ordinals and inscriptions and CoinJoin now. And so then switching to this next one, Whirlpool users sent a total of 0.44, basically half a Bitcoin in miner fees for their transactions the first week of December. Mine with Ocean Mining, you'll be unable to earn those fees since they censor those transactions. More Bitcoin for honest miners. The system works. Pull out your hash. And then as a result, he says, don't fuck with us and don't fuck with Bitcoin privacy, Ocean Mining. Over 100 petahashes pulled from Ocean since we revealed that they were enacted a policy of censoring Whirlpool transactions and other privacy-enhancing transactions. This is just the beginning. So that's an interesting, like, here's the thing. I don't know what the hell the Samurai Wallet people who have been on the show before, good people, what the hell they're doing dicking around on Bitcoin these days. Because why would you, like, there seem to be so many better ways of achieving their goals than using Bitcoin. But I respect your decision to do that regardless. And I really like that they're screwing with all the people I hate right now. So the thing is, in this determination of the chain is for X, right? Code is law, but the purpose is this. The dragnet, you know, of censorship, of exclusion, that's trying to say it's not for monkey JPEGs. Well, now this other high fee paying thing where people will pay a lot for privacy, as it turns out, there's a lot more Bitcoin in the Whirlpool than there is in the entirety of the Lightning Network. All this stuff, like, they're cleaning that out too, and they're facing blowback. So basically, this begs the question, what is the Bitcoin chain for? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I like monkey JPEGs. So we could, I mean, I think the question to me is like, who decides that, right? Because it's definitely not me. Like, I'm neither a majority holder nor a, you know, a someone who's going to stake his life and die on that hill, right? Like, I'm not in the Bitcoin, what Bitcoin is debates anymore. But I think there are some elegant solutions to this problem, right? Because if the question is who decides, and you have to make that, you know, or if the premise is that code is law, but that people can change the code, your question becomes who can change the code and who has the right to do that. But and I don't think
that
it's
is law.
Right. And I don't, you know, that's what we typically call governance. And so at some point, you know, L1s specifically will resolve back to what people are calling the social layer. Mm-hmm. But this, like, I don't think that is the only way to do it. And I see two ways to do this. One is to have formal governance processes. And that is like the, right.
Just so yet another throwdown kind of a discussion that will have to be pushed off to a later date once we can get Bonds on the show.
Trying to get Justin on here. Yeah, exactly. Justin, come out of hiding. We need to discuss this. But the second, as you know, I'm more of a proponent of, is coding these into the protocol as market mechanisms, right? Like tokenomic mechanisms, we call them. These are reactive to market data and market demand, essentially. So one protocol that's done this really well is Monero, right? So they have a dynamic block size, and that ensures that transactions will always be cheap. And they're continually optimizing the protocol so that more transactions can go through. And, you know, various other blockchains that are focused on scaling are also trying to get more throughput. But I think Monero's dynamic block size is a pretty great way of solving and addressing this issue. You know, contrast that with a protocol that has proposed formal governance processes. We were talking about how to determine, you know, how miners should determine what changes go into the protocol. And as a former member of the cult of Bitcoin Cash, I lived through this multiple times when we had the initial fork from Bitcoin in July 2017. Then we had the BSV fork in September 2018. And that we had said Nakamoto consensus, the consensus mechanism of Bitcoin is the way that we determine that. But as we figured out from developers checkpointing and taking the ticker BCH, Nakamoto consensus is not binding. So just because a miner signals one way or votes one way, it's not the only way to determine what happens. You know, and there were a lot of social factors in there as well.
Also, one thing I'd like to interject on with the hash rate thing, which kind of reminds me of, we're going to go into Thorchain Maya later, but like the way Thorchain pools stay balanced through like a big trade is there's arbitragers who come in.
Right.
So the amount of money that is in the pool is not as big as the amount of money looking at the pool ready to throw in if you need to balance to take some juicy trades. The same with hash rate in the hash war, where all of a sudden you just like with the, we had an actual honest to goodness hash war with BSV and BCH, and that was actually cool to watch. Like from as a fan of the space, student of the space, it was cool to watch. If I was in either the BSV or the BCH community at the time, it would have been a nightmare, but I was not. Yeah. So I was just watching. But then you had a lot of hash rate that just came from nowhere because it's just not profitable to mine at that level. But when you need to actually fight, all of a sudden a bunch of hash rate comes out of the woodwork, you slug it out. Roger pulls some strings, maybe. I wasn't privy to all that.
Yeah.
Pulls some strings, boom, and then BCH wins. BSV goes off its own way. And then, yeah, then you have a, maybe not a war, but you had a hash murder with eCash or whatever it was.
Yeah.
They went off their own way, and then there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, without, I don't want to go too into it, but that moment, there was a CoinSpice live stream, and that is to date the most fun that I have had in crypto, was sitting on that 8-hour live stream and just watching the hash rate move. That was like peak crypto experience, and that was in the depths of the bear market. That was the end of 2018. So
the other people on that stream, were they all just like popcorn about it? Or were there some people who were invested in it and like, oh no, like, or yeah, fuck those people. Like, were there any of those people? Because that always makes it, it's best if it's 90%, 80% popcorn, 20% cope. Like, that's the perfect mix right there.
For sure. It definitely was. And that's a good observation. I mean, we had guys that were kind of like neutral to that, where they were like open to it going one or the other way because they had, you know, they were selling the pickaxes rather than investing in one or the other asset. And then a lot of us were just like, fuck Craig Wright, like, clearly a fraud scammer. And we just wanted to see him get his due. So that was a really good time.
Yeah. But that is kind of, the thing is, it's kind of like a company, right? Ultimately, the reason why the free market works is it's brutal in deciding winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And I think that, for example, Elon Musk's companies, I think that basically they found that he is a singularly moving person, and there's a high degree of centralization around Musk for all of his things that he does. But everyone's okay with that because so far he performs super well in the market. And every single one of these individual mom and pop shops all the way up to whatever is the same kind of a way where there's a dictator at the top of it, or, you know, an owner who, you know, the market decides, you know, it's the, what was the term you called it? The ungovernance, the market ungovernance or whatever.
Market mechanisms.
Yeah. The market mechanisms are the governance structure for the free market.
Right.
And however, and so I would agree that that is the supreme form of governance, right? That's the number one. I do favor on-chain governance, explicit governance as well, though, for the example of, like, let's just say you get a large company now where a lot of people put a lot of money and it's doing well, and then you're past the point where, like, the Elon Musk figure is, like, you're banking it all on that guy, where now it's just like, okay, well, now you have a team, now you have a bunch of investors. Now you do need a board in case this guy does something dumb that you can be like, well, let's just... So even though the market, if he does something dumb, the market can punish you and win your competitor, but you don't want this whole giant company to just get collapsed because of that. So it's like a risk, it's a risk mitigation, and I would argue a reward mitigation strategy as well. It's like you're hedging. So governance is a, you know, explicit on-chain crypto governance is a market governance hedge, to where you're hedging against getting really screwed by the free market, and you might not grow as fast or be as innovative as a result. That's right. Kind of how it shakes out. So as so what I would say as my sort of conclusion to that thing, and we can have it out with Justin some other time on this, is I would say I think it's important, it's very useful for anything that's going to become big to have an explicit governance mechanism, but as like a fire extinguisher, like in case of emergency break open glass. Like, for the most part, it's the DAO that governs best, governs least. It's just generally just let things go. And it's only if someone's saying, like, you know what, let's go remove privacy from this project because it's getting spicy with all the markets and all that. And then the shareholders like, and they don't want to just do a big hash war or whatever it is and just throw money into a fork while this one's still there. And let's hope the free market makes the, like, you want to just say, like, look, we invested too much in this project. We don't want to have to just jump to a different one. Let's vote on it now and just stop that from happening. And there you go. But for the most part, just let the market work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ideal is letting the market work. And I would say, you pointed out that at one level, there's like governance, and then there's market mechanisms, and then maybe those are the top. But I would say that the highest level in the hierarchy of like ensuring outcomes is use of force. But the hope of agorism is that market mechanisms will eventually displace the use of force as the most efficient denominated in currency. And so that market mechanisms would become the preferred method of arbitration for disputes of all kinds. And so looping it back around to Coda's Law, my hope, and I think your hope probably as well, is that we can evolve away from governments which require force. You know, they threaten to put somebody in a cage for acting as some people believe is unethically. To try to prevent that behavior. But ultimately, in a place like DeFi, where there is no remediation strategy, there's no way really to reverse chains without losing the core value proposition. I think we have to find a better way. So making better regulatory agencies that don't require coercion and instead can involve community participation and consensus.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously the ideal. And I don't know if you saw, as like the final aside before we hit on the last news item about Thorchain and all that kind of stuff. The final aside is did you see my post on the way an affiliate fee model built into the protocol would have saved Bitcoin from ever having that?
I might have seen that, but that's a great take.
Yeah, and I've sort of, since I wrote that thread, let me just, I'll just throw it up on the screen so people can see it real quick. I'm not going to read my own crap. Wrong link. I'm not going to read the whole thing out loud, obviously. But basically, the idea is Thorchain and the Maya protocol, obviously, as a result, right, have this thing where swaps can have built in a way for front ends to get an affiliate fee off of this, off of each trade. And you don't need it. It's not protocol enforced. I'm just throwing up on the screen about the story I came to epiphany about how to solve crypto scaling problems through the, because Bitcoin and Ethereum both chose not to scale. Now, so I still stand by this as hugely important. The thing that I sort of walked back in the, let me see how many days, 6 days since that tweet, is first of all, Ethereum does sort of have a built-in mechanism through smart contracts where when you do a smart contract, the developer can get paid from running the contract. And so, you know, it can be built into where you don't, it's not just the only people profiting are the nodes or formerly the miners. So there was that. Also, through my research, I did find out that, first of all, you can easily do this kind of thing in wallets, in non-custodial wallets in Bitcoin, for example. In fact, Bread Wallet used to have a fee way back in the day. And I was just wondering, huh, why did it, you know, which way, Western man? Like, which way did it, like, why did it go this way and not that way? And apparently people didn't like the fee, so they forked open source, they forked Bread Wallet and without the fee and just started using that instead. So Bread Wallet's like, all right, we're going to get rid of it. And I think the ethos of, like, Thorchain and Maya protocol and all that kind of stuff, or the culture is very different today. It's very much of a, it's not this angry cypherpunk bootstrap it from, like, let's, like, they would never use Nostr, for example. It's not that kind of a culture. And because of that, they were able to do that where people are like, yeah, sure, let's just click the button, get them paid, I don't care. Whereas back in the day, it's just like, can you imagine people, if Edge Wallet, I believe, is mostly open source, right? Like but then imagine if the entirety of it all was open source, or imagine someone saying, I don't like that they have a fee per transaction, I'm just going to fork Edge Wallet. And then it actually has a economic impact where people are like, everyone's, all of Edge's customers run to this, like, without the small fee included version. I don't think that would happen today, but it set the culture and the precedent and just, like, freaking ruined Bitcoin as a result. So that was, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I love your point that this is a, you know, a great scaling solution for, or, you know, marketing solution for protocols. And I think it helps retain network effects, which are, in my view, the thing that is also keeping Edge competitive, even though they charge a small fee on exchanges.
Yeah, but not like on regular transactions.
Right. And that's like a very prudent move, I think. And that speaks to the problem that you have as a protocol as well, is if your competitors are not capturing any value, then you don't really have a lot of room to capture value. It's really tough to become profitable in an industry that your competitors are not profiting at all. But maybe, you know, I had an alternative segue to this because I'm curious whether this reduction in the effective size of the Bitcoin op return is affecting Maya protocol or Thorchain.
The answer is possibly now, definitely no in the future. And the reason for that, and I'll just hit on the basic, like, because there's not really very much news on the Thorchain Maya front in the last week that I haven't covered. Just more like, oh, look, they're doing well. Here's how they're doing well, kind of thing.
every week.
Yeah. And I can't just keep doing this. It has to be something juicy, some new metrics. But so the point is, because right now you have in the op return field, you have a certain limit of data. And in the op return field, you have to say, I want to trade this Bitcoin for Litecoin, and here's my Litecoin address, and here's the parameters I'm willing to put in. And by the way, I'm using ThorSwap, so give them their cut. All that info has to be crammed in there. And that was one of the original issues with trying to integrate Monero into Thorchain. There's other ones, other technical issues that since cropped up, and I believe SaraiDex is working really hard on making that happen to get into the ecosystem. But one of the things is Monero addresses are so damn long, just so long that they wouldn't fit in the Bitcoin op return. Other op returns, yes, but not Bitcoin. So basically, The answer is definitely yes. This will have some issues if this becomes an actual thing. If it becomes too big of a thing, you will have issues trading Bitcoin. The short term. However, ThorChain's working on something. I believe they're like, it's really just cranking out stuff all the time, called memoless transactions, which basically would allow you to take the interaction with a protocol out of the wallet itself, to where basically what would happen is, like right now, what you have to do is you go to a front end like ThorSwap, and then you go and you connect your wallet. You have to connect a wallet of some kind, or create a key store and log in with that, or create like a seed phrase wallet and move money into that, whatever. It's a connected wallet. And then you enter your parameters, and then it just, when you send to swap, it just inputs all that into the wallet stuff, and your wallet sends a transaction with all this stuff into it. Now, what they're going to do is to where that interface, you don't need to connect a wallet. You can just say, I want this for that, hit swap, and it just gives you a QR code. Then now you can just swap, you can just scan, and you send to that QR code or whatever from your wallet, which doesn't need any op return stuff anymore. You're just sending the amount to this generated for you, just your trade thing, and it goes into the protocol, and then all the trading happens. So when that gets implemented very soon, hopefully, first off, it's going to be super easy to integrate ThorChain into everything. It's going to be like old school Shapeshift, right, where you don't even need to connect the wallet. You just do whatever. But then also any op return things are just going to be completely irrelevant. But there might be some bumps before that happens. Depends on how much this censorship thing kind of happens.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to dig into it as well. We've been deep diving ThorChain and Maya and looking into Sarai as well. Mm-hmm. Very interested in these. I feel like they are as important as Uniswap was to the 2018 to 2020 DeFi run up. As to this next phase.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how that works out. I kind of believe. So my personal feeling. So obviously, before Bitcoin, there was stuff like, let's just say, Hashcash, right? It's like Bitcoin wasn't the first, but it's the first that just anyone needed to care about. And of course, there's scripting stuff on Bitcoin and all this. But Ethereum was the first smart contract chain people needed to care about. So those are the two big pillars of innovation. There's so much other innovation, from like Zcash's groundbreaking zero knowledge proof stuff to, you know, the DAO from like BitShares and Dash and stuff like that, to then, you know, whatever the hell Cosmos is doing, because everything is freaking Cosmos based these days, to like, you know, there's so much cool stuff out there. But the point is, like, the industry move lurched forward with Bitcoin. It lurched forward with Ethereum. And I feel like ThorChain, and therefore it's Thor children, right? That's the next the next lurch.
Yeah.
Is where like Uniswap is kind of like the counterparty, as opposed to Ethereum, of the, you know, DEX compared to ThorChain. Because like Uniswap lets you swap, like, I want to sound too like dismissive on this, but like it lets you swap all these like weird ETH like shitcoin casino token thingies that no one cares about amongst itself. But like ThorChain lets you swap real crypto assets from each other. Not saying the tokens aren't real, but they're much more like the small ecosystem, or not small, but you know, the ecosystem of Ethereum's stuff. It's not like, it's kind of like almost self-fulfilling, you know? So like self-filleting, as it were, right? Where you have, like, you get Ethereum so that you can trade a bunch of stuff that are all dependent on Ethereum amongst themselves. And it's like, it's all a little like casino-y in a certain way. You get chips, and then you play all the internal games, but it's not like you're getting real money. You're just getting chips, which hopefully you cash out for real money. But this is like playing with real money, or many real monies, sort of. But anyway, mm-hmm. I just think it's going to lurch everything forward.
Yeah, I think it's going to lurch everything forward too. I think there are tokens with some intrinsic value on Ethereum that are not ETH, but there are also tokens with almost no intrinsic value on ThorChain and Maya protocol.
Absolutely, as well.
So, but to your point, yeah, they're probably more worthless ERC-20s by a factor of 1,000 to 1. than there are on ThorChain. And I completely agree with you. I do feel like ThorChain and Maya are, and hopefully Sarai, are going to lurch the space forward. And I think it's the thing that we as people who have been using crypto, actually, you know, yourself, who've been living on crypto, and I lived on crypto for a time, but to use it more than the average crypto degen, I think it's something that we've been waiting for a long time. Because for a long time, the only way we could trade currencies to one another was either through a peer-to-peer kind of exchange, which most of the time was going dollars to crypto and back, or by going to some sketchy Chinese exchange that took, you know, five figures a couple times before anyone learns that shouldn't be using those. So it's a really nice alternative to the centralized custodial forms of exchanging crypto assets.
Yeah, it's like I would equate the ThorChain stuff to like an international airport, where if you have a domestic only airport, there's only so much you can do. And if it's in a big and, let's just say, important country like the US, like flying around the US is it's useful, right? It's fine. But then like if you're someplace like Iceland, which is, you know, it's funny, is having gone through like Reykjavik, the international airport is like something like 20 miles from like the domestic airport. And like there's a domestic only version, and this is the international only. It's like a siloed little like tourist, you know, airport. Or not little, but the point is, like, can you imagine if like Iceland only had its domestic airport? We had to fly all around Iceland, like to all the Icelandic airports. Like, okay, wow, this is great. So much utility. But then the international airport in Reykjavik, you can go everywhere, and that's a great, like, very high utilitarian airport, because okay, I go to the US, I go stop in Reykjavik, then I go to Dublin, then I can go to freaking Amsterdam, then I can go to wherever else. It's just so much more useful. And can you imagine if there weren't any can you imagine a world with no international airports? You could only fly domestic in the whole world. Imagine just the European experience for a second there. It's just like, how the hell do you get from Spain? Do you get from Barcelona to Amsterdam? It's like, well, maybe you fly up to, like, maybe there's an airport up in, like, you know, the north in there, and then you got to take a bus through, like, Spain, or through the end of Spain, through France, and then through Belgium, whatever it is. Like, that would suck. That would suck so hard. But the fact you can just fly to a different country is, like, that's the level of a lurch forward that the whole, like, ThorChain cross-chain ecosystem stuff gives.
Yeah, I mean, I might even use an earlier analogy where you had trains going back and forth at the turn of the century, 1900s, but you didn't quite have a lot of long-distance travel, and so now there are faster forms of getting places, which would be like, you know, ships and then planes to fly internationally, and we're coming around to maybe that magnitude of an impact in the ability to move value across chains. So I think, regardless of whether Thor and Maya and Sarai are the final forms of cross-chain decentralized exchanges, their presence marks a significant turning point in the state of DeFi.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's hit on some of these things. So first, I'm putting up Orion from the Nine Realms, the big ThorChain development team. He posted a chart, Eyes on the Prize, and ThorChain percentage of total global Bitcoin spot volume in 2023 from CoinGecko. It peaked almost at 2% in October and is now somewhere like 0.5%, but it's growing. So, I mean, for all Bitcoin trading volume, basically spot trading volume, it should be, I mean, honestly, I would expect this thing to be like, you know, the next 5 or so years should be like most of it, because I think that centralized exchanges are going to fall like dominoes, or at least they already are a little bit, but like the fact that Binance is getting slapped around a little bit is like, should tell you something. But, or at least I think the remaining centralized exchanges are probably going to just pivot to using ThorChain in their back end. And so then, even if they don't collapse, just Thorchin gets, or the other ones get that. And so then Familiar Cow, also another great dude who works on Nine Realms and stuff, he said, breaking out the popcorn to watch this stream, 115 Bitcoin swap into the WBDC pool. The pool has 65.5 WBDC. Let's see how it does. 1.6% slippage tolerance will take about 8 hours to fill. And so, like, literally, he's swapping 150 Bitcoin for 150 wrapped Bitcoin. And the pool only has, like, a third of that, kind of. Not much more than the third of that. So you, how do you get that much more money that doesn't exist in the pool? Well, that goes back to the whole potential hash rate versus current hash rate thing, where there's people eyeing the pool, and as soon as the price starts to, like, move, they're chucking WBDC back into the pool to make sure this giant 150 Bitcoin swap, damn. Look, they're chucking it in to balance it out, and the fact that it can handle this kind of, like, motion in the ocean, so to speak, the fact that it can handle this is pretty interesting, you know?
Yeah, that arbitrage as a tokenomic mechanism is really impressive. And there have been a number of things that I've been impressed with Thorchain and Maya Protocol. Mm-hmm. That is one of them, streaming swaps. And I don't have a definitive verdict on whether all of the upgrades that are rapidly coming to both of these chains are going to be secure for the long haul. Mm-hmm. But I think the attention to detail that they've put in so far in designing these mechanisms, and also the sort of the cleverness that they've used in building them, is really impressive.
Yeah, it feels like a microcosm of crypto as a whole, where crypto is just surging forward, and there's just so many people with so many ideas throwing things around, except it's all just a couple of chains. And, like, every time I get Chad on my show, he's always on a million extra things. And, like, if you haven't watched the latest episode with Chad Barifer that I did not too long, like a couple weeks ago, you probably should, because it's cool. And there's a lot of interesting stuff coming up. And he's also talking about a side project. Of course, he always has a side project called Arkeo, which is working on trying to decentralize front ends, where right now that they're centralized. And he's basically trying to turn a front ends into, like, smart contracts, where you deploy it and it's just permanent. It just keeps running. And I mean, I don't know how that works with, like, you know, like ICANN and, like, domains like that and stuff, or websites, or, like, the app stores. And that seems like it's really hard to, it's going to be one of the last dominoes of, like, centralized internet to, like, you know, fall. But I'm here for it. Just try it out. Do what you can. So one thing that is a little interesting, speaking of governance, right, is Thorchain, the Mimir update, the nodes voted that they wanted to remove impermanent loss protection. And so Thorchain said impermanent loss protection is now disabled for all LP positions. All dual LPs should be aware and responsible for the risk they take, including impermanent loss moving forward onwards. So I have a, this is for the most part a good thing, but I do have a little bit of some misgivings about it. Woody, are you familiar with their whole impermanent loss protection historically?
Maybe not historically, but I'm imagining, and from what I recall, they give Rune out to people who have suffered impermanent loss. Is that basically the idea?
And they do that in the beginning because of the pool mechanism, the way it works, especially because Rune took a giant nosedive in price from its peak down to the bottom, you know, like 90-some% or whatever. And so people who just says, I'm going to invest my Bitcoin in there, and then their Bitcoin gets trashed, and like, oh, this sucks, which is, I lost a bunch percentage-wise. It was like, I threw like a few hundred bucks in ETH in 2021, and when the chaos net age. And then that's when they were still, before mainnet, they still had some exploits. And so ETH was down for like a couple of months straight. And so I got no trading fees from that, from my small ETH position. Then ETH mooned, but because of Rune going down, I like didn't make any. So that was a giant, like that affected me to a certain extent. Like it affected my piddly little like experiment. So it didn't actually affect me at all. But the point is, you know, I did notice that that was a problem. So they had impermanent loss protection for like if you hold for over 90 days, and it's like I don't remember exactly how they calculated it, but basically then they came out with an innovation called Savers, which basically lets you take half the APYs of the pool, but then you don't have any impermanent loss protection. You just, it's single asset yield. You don't have any, you know, the opposite either. You don't get whatever. So you throw Bitcoin in the pool, you get the same amount of Bitcoin minus transaction fees, right? Out plus whatever interest you get on top of that, which is like 3.8% right now for Bitcoin, I think. And then the pool gets like double or more the fees, but then they could make even way more than that if Rune does well. But if Rune doesn't do well, they could also, they have some loss exposure. So basically Savers obsoleted the need for impermanent loss protection. However, it was still a promise that they just said, you're going to do this. This is what it's for. And at some point, the nodes voted to not have that anymore. And there you go. Governance worked, but some people are feeling a little salty about it. So I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to like who decides, right? And it's like if governance votes this way, then that's how the governance is designed. But as a, you know, weighing in on the particulars of removing the impermanent loss protection, I think that's probably a good thing for Rune in when you're looking at the value of the asset. But my main concern for all of the Thor children is the nature of providing liquidity, which is that impermanent loss is difficult but not impossible to avoid. So there is a really great protocol on Ethereum where all the innovation is happening, by the way, and there's some on Cosmos, in Cosmos. Yeah. But it's called Panoptic. And so it's basically treats Uni V3 positions as selling options. So you're selling call or put options on by providing liquidity in a pool, and you can strategically place your liquidity positions to construct a strategy that nets you only you know, a minimum amount of profit. And so Guillaume Lambert posted yesterday on Twitter that he deconstructed a liquidity provider who had done just that and guaranteed themselves that at the minimum they would earn 33 USD from USDC from their liquidity position, liquidity positions, the specific configuration of the options that they're providing through Panoptic. And I don't know how long it will take, but I would love to see something similar arise on Thorchain and Maya protocol, because you know, for a variety of reasons, that level of financial complexity is really important to DeFi. And yeah. The ability to lock in profits like that is needed for the space to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing with the impermanent loss thing, it's like a governance decision. And this is where I will sort of, I've talked about this a bunch in the past, but I'll rehash it because it might as well be appropriate to take a little bit of a dump on Thorchain after I've been saying so many glowing things about it, just to balance it out.
Well, you're not a Thorchain ambassador, so.
No, I could do that. I got to find some stuff to dump on Maya, because that doesn't jeopardize.
It's tough, right?
It's tough. It's more like, you know, oh, this chain was damn. Well, I'll mention that in a second. Well, one thing at a time. But so Thorchain, I think that if a crypto works a certain way and is advertised a certain way, people should have a reasonable, obviously the code is law and all this kind of stuff, but like people should have a reasonable expectation that that will continue. So if you say like, oh, if you stake this, then this is the percentage, like then this is, these are the rules. And if someone changes those rules, I think people have the right to be upset. And well, of course, what they do about the upsettedness is they just leave. You just play a different game, right? But the thing is with Thorchain was a little bit weird because it was run by some core developers and now it's like the Nine Realms, and it's a little foggy to me exactly who makes the decisions, but they actively advertised to a whole bunch of chains that, oh, you're going to be added next. We're going to add you and all this kind of stuff. And a bunch of communities got really salty because they just ended up reneging on those things. Just like they said, you have impermanent loss protection forever. Like this is just what we're going to do. And then the thing is, Thorchain, in they adopted a node voting mechanism, which it was referenced in that tweet, to basically make, you know, things like that, an actual governance mechanism. Of course, who comes up with which node votes are put before the nodes? I don't actually know that. But the point is they have that, and now they say, oh, look, the nodes voted. We're doing this. We can't. And so the thing is they added that in after the fact of a bunch of promises, such as ILP, such as adding certain chains. And then they sort of hid behind that. And were like, no, well, the deal's changed, but it's not us. It's the votes. But there wasn't a voting system. And they never said there would be a vote, as far as I know. They never said there would be a voting system that would. So, like, if you invest in, let's just say you decide to become like a mini Dash whale, and then the DAO votes to do something like reallocate the block reward to where it goes here or there, which has already happened twice. And you're like, hey, that's not, you know, I signed up for this. It's like, well, as long as most people have been using this, there's been a mechanism for making decisions. And so you understand that by investing in this, your co-investors could make a decision that changes things. And Thorchain, of course, didn't have that at the beginning. And Dash also, by the way, did not have it at the beginning, but for 8, pushing on 9 years, has had this. Whereas, you know, Thorchain's kind of newer. So, yes, I think impermanent loss protection needs to go. Like, there's no reason to have it now that you have savers and a bunch of other stuff. Yes, it was a democratic decision, whatever, stakeholder vote. It was like a legit vote, maybe. But it's still, there's still room for there to be a bad taste in the mouth.
Yeah, because I think what you're describing is like the social contract that existed between the users and holders. And that's why I think formalizing governance processes is so important. It's like, this is the importance of well-designed governance, that you can reasonably expect the overall sentiment and desires of the people, the stakeholders in the system, to be reflected in a vote. And in my opinion, the purest form of that that we have is markets and people paying to see the kinds of outcomes that they would like. Namely, prediction markets is a really interesting form of governance that I'm looking at and evaluating and would love to include in some of our clients at Token Dynamics. But I think that just speaks to the importance of formalizing governance processes in advance before having people opt into a system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely needs to be formalized. And who makes the rules needs to be formalized. But yeah, let's hit on a couple of my announcements. So Maya said, we're thrilled to announce that the open source Asgard DEX has broadened its support to include Maya Chain. This expansion grants Maya Protocol users direct interaction capabilities with the chain, allowing for seamless operations such as deposits, bonding, unbonding, and memos. Yay! So Asgard DEX is, I guess, one of the bigger Thorchain DEXs, like front ends, that's actually like open source. And so it has a smaller affiliate fee or whatever. The fact that it's open source means, of course, you can just like copy it and like have one with your own fee or without a fee or whatever. But a lot of these front ends, like, for example, ThorSwap came under a lot of scrutiny after they basically went offline and came back online with some basic like chain analysis kind of. They weren't super clear with exactly what, but let's be honest, it was some chain analysis stuff. So if someone tries to move stolen funds through it, they would like probably block it at the front end level or some kind of thing like that. And so because of this opaqueness, people got nervous. So it helps to have, you know, lots of support on an open source alternative to where you actually know what goes into everything. And then beyond that, MayaScan, which is a great, my favorite, my dashboard, of course, is MayaScan, but the MayaScan team has since done something called Thor Scanner, which is a Thorchain version of that. And I think it's the best Thorchain interface. So if you want to look at interface for stats, I should say. So if you want to look at those, then there you go. But they start something called MayaSwap, which is a kind of like a front end thingy for swapping the Maya token, which is it's not cacao. It's not the gas token for the liquidity token or whatever. It's purely an investment token where if you hold Maya, then you get Maya holders get 10% of all transaction fees on the network. So if you want to speculatively invest in the Maya protocol as a project, rather than buying this weird Kakao token, you'd buy the Maya token and just you get 10% of everything. And so that's what there was no VC stuff involved with the team. The team minted 1 million Maya tokens, and then they just gave them out or sold them to people, OTC, you know, peer-to-peer, whatever, to finance their stuff. And so the entire funding from the core team or whatever comes from that or from the little Kakao earnings from the Maya tokens they still have. And so basically they need, that's one of the reasons why Maya has had this crazy explosive year of growth, is because they've hustled, because they just have no coin issuance, just nothing to pay for anything. And they're just like, we're not getting any money unless we run out there and get some goddamn customers. And they went out and they got some customers, and there you go. So that's a little thing on Maya. Let me just hit on a criticism of Maya, because we're talking about the criticism of Thorchain.
Before we do that, I want to say that I like Alex and respect him for a lot of reasons, but that is one of them. That I spoke to him, I think, like 6 months ago, maybe for the first time, and he said, yeah, we're bootstrapping. We're just not, you know, we're not taking VC funding. We're just, you can buy some, I don't think he offered Maya tokens, but he said there are two tokens and that we're using to bootstrap the system for ourselves. We're using Maya, and then there's Kakao, and we separate those, and it creates like this elegant system. So the thing that I originally really liked about Maya was that it separated the use cases for tokens and made it an elegant, easy to understand system. And that is so important and underrated in tokenomics.
Yes. And that's one of those things where, like, Thorchain is great, but, like, because it's, like, the version one, a limitation of that is just kind of like Bitcoin's 10-minute block size. It doesn't need that. Like, almost every single crypto since then has had, like, a 2.5-minute or 2-minute on average for Monero. And then Zcash had a 2.5-minute. Shorten it to 1.25 minutes, and like then of course all the ETH ones are like seconds and stuff, and so it's like you don't need to do that because Rune, people bought and sold Rune speculatively. They're like, how's the project going to do? I'm going to hold Rune. Oh, I'm going to dump Rune. And then also because of the inflation, if you're holding Rune and it's not going up in value because people aren't like it's a bear market or whatever, then you're paying by holding. You're paying the network to run, and people just tend to dump that more. And then there you go. Whereas Kakao not only has no issuance, so even if it's not doing as well, you're probably not going to dump it as hard because you're not paying out through inflation, through coin issuance. But also there's this other speculative token they've like pushed, be like, here, if you want to speculate on if the project's doing well, get this one, and this will reflect the value directly. Because even if the Maya token slowly loses value, I mean, if the Kakao token slowly loses value over time, which I don't think it will, but just say it would. But there's increasing usage of the network. Then if you buy the Maya token, you're still going to be doing well. You're going to be earning more and more money from real usage, not from anything else. And that's one of the biggest problems, in my opinion, with digital cash tokens, is their digital cash coins, is that the end money is the end user product is the speculative asset. And so whenever, can you imagine if the price of Amazon goods and services tracked the price of Amazon stock, that like all of a sudden, like it took a dive, all of a sudden, oh, it's cheap, let's buy this. Or it spiked, all of a sudden everything gets expensive. Mm. No one would use Amazon. It's nonsense. Yet that's what every cryptocurrency does. And I just think that like the only solution to that, the interim solution to that is of course, either add some other thing to speculate on, like a Maya token, or you just use your crypto as gas to power a stable coin until everything gets flat enough so you can do things. But it's one of the reasons why, so one of the big things people don't realize, they're like, oh, you know, Zcash is too volatile, Monero this, or like, oh, Litecoin, if only Litecoin didn't up and down. And there's a technical reason that it happens, a technical deficiency, a tokenomic deficiency, as you will.
Yeah, I mean, we probably might differ slightly on our opinions on this, but the thing that I love about the separation of the Maya and Kakao token is that the Maya token tracks the fees, or should track the fees, right? It's a dividend token, but the Kakao token maps to the value of the assets in the system, which can go up in one of two ways, right? It can be that Bitcoin is going up, and so the value of the assets that it's paired against is going to tend to increase, or the number of assets that are in the system, the volume of Bitcoin and the addition of other assets can cause it to increase. So both of the assets in Maya protocol track the success of the system in different ways. And I think it's, there are trade-offs in the principles of tokenomics. This is my work on the tokenomics trilemma is, speaks to the trade-offs in systems. When you capture a lot of value, there are economic security considerations. But I really like the intuition that Maya's had to give their assets some fundamental value and track the value of the ecosystem rather than just relying on speculation for increases in price. And I would say the hidden factor is the supply that is not used in the Maya protocol, but is just held speculatively. As well as there are some considerations with liquidity providers, as I mentioned earlier, but the non-circulating supply is another consideration, and I think. But all else equal, I really like Maya and Thor protocols' designs and their intuitions about how cryptocurrencies accrue value, and I think we're moving in the right direction in protocol design in that way.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And one thing that I'm going to just open up the scanner things on both of these, right? I love stats. Like, I'm not very smart with numbers. I love graphs though, because they're like a visual depiction of what I'm too stupid to interpret on my own. But so you're looking at the thorscanner.org/stats, and it just shows like the swap volume, what is it? Yesterday was 153 million swap volume. Not bad. It's getting up there. But the swap fees part, cross-chain fees per day, is about 54 grand per day, which is, if you go to then cryptofees.info, which is the leaderboard, the scoreboard for actual adoption, kind of, because it's like, who's actually making the money here? Ethereum's one-day fees, Ethereum's still the king, at 14 million a day in fees. And Bitcoin has gotten a lot better with the orders. It's half that, right? And BNB is 700 and whatever. So going down the list here, Polygon is like 39 grand. So Polygon is less profitable, has less revenue than Thorchain typically. And so, the Polygon's pretty big. So Thorchain's starting to get up there as far as actual stuff. Now, if you look at the Maya, because Maya is like a teeny like competitor or complement to Thorchain, I should say. Swap volume on, let's just pick a more typical day of the 6th of December, 2 days ago, was at like 2.9 million in volume on that day. And then also that day, the fees were $10,334. So definitely not in the same quite league, but that's like a quarter of Thorchain. That's still pretty good. And if you look, going back to the crypto leaderboard thingy here, Polygon, like, what is 10,000 more than? Well, it's almost as much as Cardano. So already Maya is barely exists and is a cheap knockoff of Thorchain, whatever. But I'm saying
little sister.
It's the hot little sister, as they've called it.
The hot little sister meme. That's so great.
So ruthless. But so
yeah,
it's already making Cardano levels of stuff. And Cardano is like a top coin. It's already making a lot more than Dogecoin. And then it's like you go down the list, a Litecoin, Monero, Bitcoin Cash is $364. Like it's making like, many times what that is. And so I did a tweet the other day, which I don't need to throw up on the screen, but basically saying that the Thorchain Bitcoin Cash pool, for example, makes more than the entirety of the Bitcoin Cash network does. And I think it's probably the same with the Dash pool in Maya, that the Dash pool makes more in fees than the whole Dash network on its own. It's just like with these like low cost UTXO kind of things. Could be same thing could be for Litecoin, although Litecoin does see a lot of like real usage these days. If you look at the transaction volumes, it's 867,000 transactions. Like, it's eclipsed Bitcoin in the last bit. So it's, you know, the real Lightning Network, right? It's Litecoin. But they're still making like under $2,000 a day in fees for the whole network. So we're not quite seeing that. But the point is the sustainability, which then causes people to want to, you know, proof of work coins mine for staking, stake, provide liquidity, do whatever stuff is required. It's like the business is booming. And that's one thing that I think is going to be really weird to see with Bitcoin is Bitcoiners are not ready to become a monkey JPEG chain. They're just not. They're not going to, they don't want to do that. However, they have no other way of paying the bills right now. And the miners who decided to fork, well, theoretically, technically, yes, maybe, but not in reality as much, they want money. And it seems like people are paying for, overwhelmingly, monkey JPEGs and stuff or whatever ordinals. I don't mean to be so disrespectful, but it is funny. They're paying for all that kind of ordinals stuff, and they're paying for like privacy. And they're just not really interested in all this other stuff that the maxis seem to like think they should do. So, you know, what is it? The golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules, right? You pay the bills, you can say anything. And like, for example, I tell people that all the time. If I'm moderating a Discord that's on a volunteer basis and they complain, you should do, I just say, pay me and you can complain. Otherwise, shut up. Like, I'm, and so pay me is the whole thing. And Thorchain Mai are booming. Obviously, ETH is booming. Bitcoin is booming as well in its own controversial way. And yeah, make money or GTFO. That's a good place to wrap it up, maybe. What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, that's, I feel like that covers the big news of the week. I'm glad we got to cover Code is Law. We got to talk about Bitcoin and the impending block size debate all over again, or opportune debate. And we covered Maya and Thorchain, which I'm always excited to talk about and hear from you on.
Yeah. So it's Shill O'Clock. What you going to show?
Shill O'Clock. We're shilling Token Dynamics Twitter today. Okay. If you guys are interested in the kind of ideas that I have, you're going to find a lot more of them at Token Dynamics on Twitter. It's all one word. And then I am Official ESC on Twitter. And if any of you in the audience, I'd imagine, Joel, you have a lot of developers in the audience. So if you guys are listening into this one and curious about what good tokenomics look like and how to do that well, how to design your protocols so that they don't get exploited and collapse for a lack of incentive alignment, then reach out to me. Any platform is fine. Twitter is going to be the best. Official ESC on Twitter. Yep. And our corporate account, Token Dynamics.
All right. Put all that on the screen. Thanks for stopping in for a fun little chat. This has been great. Everyone, if you're still watching, please hit a subscribe button. And of course, if you're on Twitter, you're not following me. Why? Come on. Get your boy monetized. I'm really close. So really close to that 5 million. I don't know if that means I'm close to actually monetized, but like whatever. Yeah, so thanks for watching. Next week, obviously the rundown, but also I believe it'll be the final episode of the Zcash podcast. Finally wrapping that whole thing up. So if you want to join Ian Sagstetter, he's a good man, for some interesting takes, do that. And then following that, the 2 weeks following that are going to be holiday specials, which are long shows, tons of people, all that kind of cool stuff. So yeah, just letting you know what to expect. Don't forget that your phone is spying on you. Taxation is theft. Fiat is a scam. And live all in crypto before it's too late. And GMI before you DMI didn't make it. All right. Peace, guys. Have a good weekend.